Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host today. So today we have a special guest, one of my favorites to read about. We have Roger Ibbotson. How are you doing today, Roger?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
Great. Well, we're really lucky to get Roger on the show. We did a lot of work on our end and pulled a lot of teeth and pulled a lot of favors as well. So really happy to have him on the show. And just for you that don't know who Roger is, you open the door to your cave and you hopefully will get a lot out of this show. So Roger is a professor at Yale School of Management. He's also the chairman and CIO of Zebra Capital Management. It's a hedge fund. He's also the founder and advisor and former chairman of Ibbotson Associates, which was acquired by Morningstar. He's written numerous books and articles, including stocks, bonds, bills, and inflation. And he's just a wealth of knowledge. So I wanted to give a warm welcome to Roger. So I want to kind of start off with getting your opinion on the markets. And I don't always do this, but I think given your experience and your academic credentials, I'd love to get your insight on what you think of the markets right now.
Well, actually, I have to say, I'm pretty surprised that the market, the overall market, is actually up for the year and following a big year last year, despite what's going on with our economy. I did actually, I was in a, had an interview with USA Today, I think last week, so I had a few comments about that. But it's not a broad market rise because it's really based on just a few of the handful of stocks that are really doing well. And you can guess what those are, the kind of FANG type stocks that they're the largest cap stocks, really, in the S&P, for example. They are the ones that are actually driving this whole big rise because areas of the market like the smaller cap stocks, they're not really doing that well. It's kind of a surprising market. I can't say that I could have forecasted this ahead of time. I didn't know that this was going to happen. I definitely felt that it was a security picker's market because so many things are going on and with COVID that it matters what you might want to buy and sell and so forth. But I definitely wouldn't have thought the market should be up. And I am still surprised that that's happening.
That's actually a great point that you bring up, Roger. So if you think about the stock market, we've had a, prior to COVID, we had a stock market with 2 to 3% unemployment rates. And now we have somewhere between 13 and 20%, depending on how you measure it, which is a huge difference. And yet the stock market is or was recently at all-time highs. I want to talk a little bit about the difference between the economy and the stock market. Can you talk a little bit about that and why there's a difference there? Because a lot of people think they're the same thing.
Well, I generally think they're the same thing. I think they're generally connected. The top five stocks now make up over 20% of the index, and they're doing well. But those aren't the same companies that have all the jobs. They don't make a big percentage of the jobs in America. And in fact, a lot of the jobs are really hotel, restaurant, service jobs and things like that. They often the jobs that really hardly show up in the stock market at all. There are really two economies here. I think over the long run, they're connected, but over the short periods, they can definitely have a dichotomy that we can have certain technological firms that don't need that many people, basically, doing very well, and service firms, which are loaded with people, that really are not participating much in the stock market.
We all kind of look at the economy from the lens of our own lens. Whether you're in finance, you get this sense that everyone else has that same lens. Or if you know, in the service sector, you feel like everyone is the same. And I think there's such a broad spectrum of people that all have different experiences right now. You know, looking at this market in general, obviously there are people who've been big winners, and then there's people who've obviously lost a lot. It seems to be very kind of extreme, almost like our political system, which is not a nod to get into that conversation, but rather that, you know, looking at these extremes of people who are doing better than they've ever done, or people who are doing worse than they've done in a long time. Why is the market acting that way, and yet somehow the stock prices are still remaining high? To me, that seems like that doesn't really make sense. Why would something like that happen? And is it something that could be sustainable long term?
One of the things we're trying to understand is to what extent we have a temporary or a permanent shift in the economy. Because, you know, a lot of us can work quite well from home. A lot of companies having people work from home, it doesn't really affect the business that much. whereas other businesses, it completely affects their business. So, and some companies that actually say, if you're getting deliveries of things, these are things, companies like Amazon, they're thriving in this kind of environment because this is ideal now because people aren't going to the stores. They don't go to physical stores as much. They're ordering things much more online. It's a big jolt. And the question is, what will happen as it'll be a while, but when the vaccines come, probably next year sometime, what will happen? Will we start shifting back to our other ways of doing business, or will there be some permanent shifts? And I think there will be, some of this will be permanent shifts because we've actually had to change our behavior so much that we actually have a much faster permanent shift in the economy here.
Do you think it's shift, or do you think it's just like accelerating trends that were already in place?
These trends were already in place, and they're certainly accelerating them, but it's accelerated at such a rate that I'd have to call it a shift, actually. even though it is accelerating trends that were already in place, but it's so much accelerating it. That's the point here, I guess. So yes, it's hard to know. I think we will have a bit of a shift back, though, once we can actually interact with each other again directly.
You know, we've kind of got into these habits of the new normal, as people are calling it, and I wonder if we'll be able to go back to the old normal. Do you have thoughts on that?
Not completely, but we'll partially go back. On the other hand, I think it's presumptuous to think that these companies that have benefited so much can permanently benefit because competition is going to creep in there. I talked about how the top five stocks and the indexes are, by capitalization, are over 20% of the indexes of the, say, the S&P index or even the Russell 1000 index or so forth. Those top five stocks, though, shift. Like, we had a pretty big percentage in the late 90s that were the top five stocks. The only one of those top five stocks that is still there is Microsoft. So it's another set of companies. So even though certain companies really might do well in this environment, it's not permanent. There will be competition coming back in. It's very hard to hold your spot forever here. And I think the markets are acting like they will be held forever.
Well, let's talk about that. You just mentioned something I wasn't aware of. I know the S&P, you said it was 20% of those five companies, and I think the NASDAQ is probably like 40%, or at least it was before some of these splits. And that's a huge component. So what happened in the late 90s? Was it very similar? Obviously, we know how that ended, but was it kind of a similar composition of the indexes?
Actually, the concentration is even heavier now than the late 90s. But definitely in the late 90s, it was a technology bubble, it turned out. It really popped. And it took a long time for technology to get back to where it was after that. People kind of knew that it was a bubble in the late 90s. They knew that the technology stocks were being priced at amazing, incredible prices, unrealistic prices. But even though they knew it, it was very hard to make money at this. For example, I had one of my colleagues who knew this and was showing, I won't give his name, he was shorting the technology stocks through the late 90s. He turned out to be correct, of course, by the early 2000s. But by that time, he had lost so much money, he didn't really have any money to invest to take advantage of this. So it's very hard to know when the turning points actually occur. And even though you might understand distortions in the market, it's very hard to actually take advantage of it.
Shorting the market's hard. I talked to a lot of hedge fund managers, and they say it's one of the hardest things that they could do is short, because you could be wrong for a long period of time and lose a lot of money. Eventually, you might be right, but you might be out of the game by the time you're right. Hard to kind of stomach that over long periods of time. Because, I mean, technology right now is still a higher concentration, and it doesn't seem to be a technology bubble necessarily. I would say it probably is in valuations, but it doesn't seem that way. In the late 90s, everyone knew that the valuations were absurd. And now I feel like people don't, quote unquote, know that. They feel like they can justify some of these tech companies going through the roof despite all reason. What do you think the outgrowth is going to be of technology, given the fact that it's such a strong and permanent influence on our society going forward?
Well, I think technology will be very important going forward, just as, frankly, a lot of things were discovered in the late 90s. There was something really going on then. We were pricing by multiples of revenues or even internet clicks and things like that. Now the large technology companies are actually making money, you know, so they're So they're being priced at really high levels that presume that they're going to keep growing at fast rates. And I think the natural thing what will happen is competition will creep in and they will get displaced. Just like those successful companies in the late 90s ultimately got displaced. They're not in the top five anymore.
When you look at investing in equities, are you more of a value investor or a growth investor? Do you have a preference there?
I'm effectively more of a value, not the traditional, like Fama French value type of thing, because I do think the book to market is kind of a way of basically buying more archaic type of companies, because who needs all that property, plant, and equipment, basically. But other measures of value, things like cash flows and revenue and a more higher level profits, gross profits, before some of these depreciation and things like that get in there. These are all things that I definitely consider. So yes, I'm a value person, but not by, I guess, by some of the measures of value.
When you're looking at value investing, like how are you measuring a company? Because I talk to a lot of value investors and they all have a little bit of a different tilt on how they measure value. How do you look at that?
Well, it's all kinds of measures of value, but I don't say I'm primarily a value person because that's just one aspect of what we would look at. But what we would look at in a value context is more look at the up the income statement rather than the bottom line so much earnings or looking at the balance sheet of a company. It's more looking at the higher level of more of the growth kind of profits of the company. And they're much less sensitive to the accounting gimmicks that are going on and things like that. So I would look at more, you try to look at what the company's actually accomplishing rather than, well, I mean, the whole idea of depreciation and so forth. And these are ways that accountants use, of course. I certainly think it's a valid profession, but they don't necessarily capture what's going on actually in terms of changes in value.
Maybe this question may be a little too deep, but I kind of get the impression that the accounting profession was built based on old businesses and some of the newer businesses may not be accurately captured so well with some of the accounting metrics.
Well, for example, the intangibles, they get expensed. So if you spend a lot of your research expenditures on developing things, that's all expensed. Whereas if you built a property, that's depreciated. And so it depreciated over 20 years or whatever it is. They're handled completely differently, even though they're both basically investments that people are making. So if you handle your investments differently, if the accountants handle them differently, then that's caused distortions in the earnings numbers. If you look at the earnings numbers, for example.
That throws a lot of beginning investors for a loop when they start looking at, you know, earnings per share. They're looking at all these different measures, and it may not be apples to apples. You know, if you're measuring a railroad company versus a tech stock, you're going to have, you know, very different numbers. I know one of the areas that I find that I'm sure they're out there, but I have not found a lot of people who know how to value this well are property casualty insurers. Because of the float, the numbers seem to mess with people's heads. They seem to not understand the valuation. And it's, from my standpoint, it's really hard, but I see companies like that and say, well, there's an opportunity because most people aren't looking there. Are there any areas of the economy that you find to be particularly interesting, maybe because they're being ignored or because they're just, you know, maybe they're not high on people's radar screen?
Let me say the whole idea, and I do have this CFA Institute monograph and several articles on popularity and pricing models based on popularity. But essentially, the idea is that there are always parts of the market that get too popular. And if things get too popular, the prices get high. And then areas of the market where the market kind of ignores. One way you kind of can measure this is just how much trading activity there is and so forth, how much interest there is in particular companies. And the more action there is in a company, actually the higher the price of the company. But actually that to us tells us that the long run returns are going to be actually worse. You benefit when popularity is increasing. That's the best time to buy a stock because that change in popularity is the big kicker. And of course, as popularity gets worse, you have a big drop in the price of stock. But then long term, you'd actually rather buy the stocks that are overlooked, that are less popular. that are not being traded as much, that are, these are the stocks that it's easier to improve a company that is not doing so well than it is to keep sustaining and grow, improve a company even more that is really doing well. So it's actually the changes that matter. And so it's easier to actually take advantage of the changes when you buy something that's not in great shape. Whereas most people want to avoid those companies, of course, that are not in great shape. Actually, the overlooked companies are the companies that there's usually something the matter with them.
Would you characterize the popularity concept as more like momentum investing?
That's more like the change in popularity. Momentum is that when things are going up, people are getting more, it's getting more popular. And certainly to the extent that momentum works, you ride the changes here, but ultimately it comes to an end and the stocks that have high momentum end up getting too popular and actually have poor returns after a while.
I always look at like the growth versus value concepts, and some people I figure are more growth minded, some people are more value minded. I have more of a value leaning, but then I look at value stocks for the last 10 years, they've underperformed. And every year I hear the same thing from portfolio managers. This is going to be the year. We're going to break out. This is when value is going to take off. And I think, you know, how is that going to happen when we're such in a popularity type of market? Like, oh, what are you investing in? Oh, the five, those big five stocks? Great. Let's put all our money there and let's forget that there are other stocks in the market. How do you kind of balance that out when it's happened for such a long period of time?
I always say, first of all, that the whole value premium is behavioral for the most part. It was put forward as almost a classical idea where there's supposed to be value risk premiums. It turns out that value is less risky than growth, so it's not really a risk premium. But it was more like something that people wanted to avoid because these were the less interesting companies, the less cleverest companies. But there's so many quants and other kinds of managers who got on the bandwagon that value itself might have gotten too popular. That may have actually caused value to get overpriced. Now, of course, I don't think it's overpriced at this point after a 10-year poor run. So I think it's probably a good deal, but I don't know when it's going to turn. And I guess both of us probably suffered somewhat by the fact that to the extent we're at all linked to value, any link to the value of almost any measure has not done well over the last 10 years.
No, I would agree with that. It's been a hard category to support. I mean, let's talk about some of the drivers behind why things have been maybe a little bit out of whack or out of control. Let's talk about interest rates because, you know, interest rates have such an important impact on the markets. We've had low interest rates for, well, virtually since 2008. And we had a period where they bumped up a little bit, but they're still historically low. In your mind, like, what is really the full impact of low interest rates on the markets?
Well, first of all, just a little background. Actually, interest rates topped out back in 1980, 81. And if you look at a graph of them, you can just see them like going up all the way to 1980. Post-war, basically, they kept on climbing for roughly 40 years or so up until 1981. And subsequently, they've been dropping. And this has made bonds a wonderful investment over the last, since 1980, that's 40 years, because with a bond, you get not only the yield, you get the yield, which started out very high, double digits even in the early 80s, and then you get a capital gain from the drop in yields. And so a bond investor has done great over the last four decades. But now we have rates that are really below 2%, below 1% even. It's hard to imagine that we're going to keep on dropping these interest rates. So on a go-forward basis, you're going to get that yield, and I don't know if rates will start going up again, but they can't go down much more, I don't think. So you're basically going to get a near zero yield from bonds and no capital gain and maybe a big capital loss. The only way you can get a capital gain if yields go negative, and that can happen, as we've seen in Europe and Japan and so forth, but that's not a good prediction. So I think bonds are a pretty bad investment right now. They're not likely to deliver more than 1% or 2% return.
Well, that's going to be problematic for all those 60-40 models that people have been using for quite a number of years. You know, 40% of your money is in bonds earning nothing with the potential to lose money. I would think that would cause a big problem. What are some other kind of impacts of these low interest rates? Because there's so many, it's hard to keep track of.
Well, just going historically, you mentioned 60-40. Well, 60-40 actually was a hard benchmark to beat historically because 40% in bonds did so well. Actually, 60-40 was a very hard benchmark to meet historically, but would be a very easy benchmark to meet going forward because you're not going to get anything out of bonds going forward. So that's a totally different story, I guess, looking back versus going forward. And of course, one of the things that people get confused about is they often want to extrapolate the returns. And it's not reasonable to extrapolate bond returns, of course, when they've got the capital gain from the dropping yields in the past and they're not going to get that in the future. That's the first big point about bonds. They've had great historical returns, but they're not going to have good returns going forward. Now, in that environment where bond returns are so low, what should we do? You know, I mean, it's kind of hard to find good investments here. Should we invest in the equity market? And I generally, I've got to say over my lifetime, I've pretty much been all in on the equity market, which has worked out very well, I will say. I, like everybody else, am a little wary of the equity market when the economy has so collapsed and the equity market is still up this year.
They're creating a lot of tail risks, right? I mean, bonds were typically a safe investment, which right now I would say is probably, I wouldn't even put it in the safe category, maybe lower volatility, but certainly not safe. And then you've got everybody, well, not everybody, but the bond market is much larger than the equity market, and the bond investors looking for yield are pushing that money into equities looking for yield through dividend stocks or what have you, and just continue to pushing these prices up. It seems to me like they're just creating this huge tail risk that at some point, things reverse and it's violent, but I can't figure out what would be the cause of that because who's going to invest? There are people in bonds. I don't want to make this out to be like they're not, but it seems like a lot of people I talk to have no interest in bonds. So that seems to be a big imbalance there.
And you can go try to reach for yield by going into lower credit bonds, but that's actually pretty dangerous, particularly in this environment where I think you could have higher bankruptcies and so forth. So that's probably not the solution. I got to say, one thing that I've actually been involved in is building indexes with the insurance industry, which have been used in some accumulation annuity products where they basically insure the downside and give you some partial participation in the upside. The reason why that could even be attractive, though, is because there's no real alternative in the bond market. And then the stock market has had wonderful returns and probably will in the future, but this is a dangerous time to buy, to really load up in stocks. And so it's actually an opportunity for the insurance industry to have products that could serve the needs of people.
It brings up an interesting question because I know back in 2008, a lot of the financial institutions took on a lot of risk and, you know, many of them didn't survive. In doing something like that, the insurance companies are taking on that risk. How are they able to maybe not fall prey to the same problems that the financial sector or the banks really fell to in 2008?
Well, let me say, if you're going to buy an insurance product, you better make sure you're buying from a company that is not just reputable, but can stand behind the products. Because if they're insuring something, they have to be able to cover it when they need it and so forth. So basically, you need the highly rated insurance companies that could actually deliver on their insurance. And yes, insurance companies can make mistakes. And ultimately, they're insuring us, but at some point, they can't provide it anymore.
I want to get back to this point, then we can kind of move on. But, you know, looking at the markets now compared to where they are and their overvaluation, and I see some of these other institutions that provide valuations, and some of them are predicting that basically negative returns across the boards, except for maybe some emerging markets and the value area seem to be attractive, but the rest of them seem to be, you know, very unattractive. What do you think about the future performance of the market considering where we are and let's say like a 10-year outlook? How should investors be looking at that?
Well, I will say that my general view is you shouldn't, as individuals, or even most professionals really, try to time the market because it's very difficult to get it right. And yes, when the COVID starts coming out, I certainly predicted myself that the economy was going to get wrecked by this. But it turned out that the economy did get wrecked, but not the stock market. It did at first, but then it came back. I don't think we should try to time the market, basically. I think you should have a pretty strong equity position in the market, and sometimes you're going to get hurt by it. But generally, you shouldn't try to time by the economics of it, because it's hard to call this. What you should do, though, is I've written on your life cycle, for example. People who are young, they've got, I've written on human capital. One of the things I wrote with the CFA Institute with several colleagues was lifetime financial advice and human capital, asset allocation, and insurance. And essentially, it tells you how you should invest over your lifetime, because earlier in your lifetime, when you're in your 20s and 30s and so forth, you've got so much human capital, which is the present value of all your earning power. And then as you start aging, you start using up your human capital and you start relying more on your financial capital. But early in your lifetime, with all that wage earning potential that you have, that's almost like a bond, because it's pretty steady income. And so the financial part of your investments can be all in effectively, because if you've got so much bond-like human capital wage income, then the financial capital can be all equity. And so I think I actually recommend always for people in the 20s and 30s to go 100% equities. But as you start approaching retirement, you have to start changing that mix, and you can't take that much equity risk anymore, because it might you can't cover it with your wage income anymore. And so you actually have to reduce the risk of your portfolio. What I have to say, I guess, is it has to do with where you are in your life. And those earlier in their life, all equity, and start getting less equity as you start approaching retirement.
It sounds like you're kind of referencing the sequence of return risks that people have at certain ages. Is that kind of accurate statement?
Well, yeah, it's certainly a sequence of negative returns right prior to retirement, when you have the most wealth, financial capital can impact your whole retirement. I would recommend that you take less of that risk as you get into those years.
Yeah, so I wanted to kind of end with the topic of inflation. So as you can see behind me is the Federal Reserve, which apparently I'm the only one here. Everyone else is wearing masks. So
what's the deal? They've already got they're pretty busy, because they're printing money all the time in that building behind you.
They're bringing people off the streets just to print more money to get it out. Come on, let's print.
I mean, they don't literally print. You know,
yeah.
They do it in other ways, but they're basically increasing the money supply. But they're building up their balance sheet.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that a little bit, because really when we kind of look at this, and this happened in 2008 and it's happening now, where, you know, the market took a huge dip and the Federal Reserve comes in on their white horse and just saves the day and just starts printing money. I think people hear that and they think, well, we're going to have hyperinflation, you know, the price of gold is going to go to the moon and your dollars are going to be worthless and we're going to be carrying around wheelbarrows full of cash to buy a piece of bread. But none of that's happened. It's almost the reverse. I mean, I wouldn't say we've had deflation, but I'd say we've kind of played around with it for a number of years in the last 12. How do you look at inflation historically and kind of going forward? What do you think is going to happen?
The traditional story is when you increase the money supply, that causes inflation. What's sort of different now, they're buying bonds effectively. And they're holding a lot of treasury bonds and other bonds, even corporate bonds, all kinds of bonds. When you buy bonds, though, you're pumping money into the economy, but it's not necessarily going to consumers. I mean, who holds these bonds? It isn't your typical consumer. It's these investors of some sort. And so they have to do something with that money. I actually think that the Fed has been one of the main reasons, actually, why the equity market has done so well. And why the bond yields are so low, because all that money, which I guess we would have traditionally thought might go into consumption goods, is not going into consumption goods. It can't really go into consumption goods because so many parts of the economy are really shut down. I mean, if the supply isn't there, there's nothing to spend it on anyway. We're not traveling. We're not going to resorts. We're not going to fancy hotels. We're not doing any of these things, but we have to do something with that money, and we put some of it in the stock market and some of it in the other bond markets, and we push the rates down to nothing, and we, I think, somewhat artificially push the stock market up. So I think the Fed policies are ineffective at boosting the economy here. but they're not ineffective at increasing the markets, if that's what they want to do.
That appears to be what they're doing, because they keep hammering the same nail over and over. And so I guess you have to assume to some degree that that's what they want, because it's not solving the underlying problem. As we kind of wrap up here, any kind of final thoughts that you can give our listeners for things that they should be thinking about, given where we are in the markets, or just, you know, if they want to be better investors going forward?
Well, I think it all gets down to that. First of all, you want to be in the market long term. We experts can't really call the directions of these markets and get it right. So you want to essentially be a part of the market. You'll probably get it wrong if you try to pick your timing. But also, I would say that the kind of stocks that ultimately will do the best are the ones that are the overlooked stocks. Don't buy the hot stocks. They may be doing great right now. Those stocks get too popular and they get overpriced, basically. In general, I have models. I have even called a PAPM, Popularity Asset Pricing Model, how to price assets. And essentially, it prices assets, the most popular assets have higher prices but lower expected returns.
We'll definitely put link to the show notes for a lot of Roger's stuff, because he's a wealth of knowledge in some of the stuff he's written. So Roger, where can people find more about you and some of the papers and books you've written? I find them to be really, really informative.
Well, they can either go to the Yale site and look for me as a faculty member, and some things will be listed there, or they can go to a Zebra Capital site and where I'm the chairman. Those sites, yes.
So that was a great interview with Roger Ibbotson. I'm really, really thankful we got him on the show. And I have to thank Barb for that one, for connecting us. Roger's the kind of guy that you really are glad you had a chance to interview. He's such a wealth of knowledge and he's such a well-known person. Now that we kind of get into the panel portion of the show, let's bring in our very own Barbara Friedberg. How are you doing today, Barb?
Doing great, Kirk. How are you?
Doing great. We also have our very own Megan Gorman.
Hi, Kirk. I'm doing well. And I know Barb doesn't like to toot her own horn, but she had written a really great article where she had interviewed Roger Ibbotson called A Market Boom Versus the Struggling Economy. And everyone should check it out. So, Barb, I'm just giving you a little shout out there.
You're too kind.
No, it's a really good article. So people should read it.
We will put that in the show notes for all our listeners, because, yeah, it's definitely worth reading. Also, we have a new panelist this week. We have Nicole Tenenbaum. How are you doing today, Nicole?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, good. And for all the listeners who are not familiar with Nicole, she works with Megan. She's a wealth of knowledge, and really glad we have a chance to have her on this panel today. Looking back at the interview, Barb, what were some of your takeaways that you heard from the interview with Roger?
I'm so glad you asked, because now I can just finish on the entire show discussing my own takeaways, because this was just a wealth of knowledge. And I think one of the most unique takeaways came from the bond discussion near the end of Dr. Ibbotson's interview and his conversation about how in the past, with higher interest rates, bonds were a really viable place to put your money, whereas today the bond landscape is totally and completely different. So that was my biggest takeaway. And I know we'll be talking more about this as the show moves on.
Yeah, absolutely. That's going to be a big topic here today, is talking about bonds. So, Nicole, what about you?
I would certainly echo what Barb said about bonds. I think that was certainly a surprising portion of the discussion for me. And I'm sure we'll touch on this later, as you mentioned. In addition, I think the conversation around the economy versus the stock market, the differences we're seeing there and the dispersion, was really top of mind as well.
Megan, what about you? Thoughts from the interview?
I agree with both the things that Barb and Nicole said, but sort of playing off of the discussion about the economy versus the stock market, you know, what he said really resonated about the concept of a K-shaped recovery. Specifically, Nicole and I work in the high net worth space. So what we've experienced with our clients over the past 8 months has been very different than I think what a lot of other Americans have experienced. So that sort of resonated, because it really showed the fact that there's some real challenges ahead.
And actually, let's kind of tie that into the next topic here, where we talk about the economy versus the stock market, because I know I've been hearing this a lot from my clients and from people that I talk to, are like, hey, we've got arguably between 13 and 20% unemployment, depending on what measures you're looking at. You know, the stock market is at all-time highs. Businesses are going out of business, and a lot of people in this country are having a hard time, but yet the stock market's at all-time highs. You know, what is that all about? Nicole, what are your thoughts? Because I know you had a lot of thoughts before the show on the economy versus the stock market. How do you explain the difference there for our listeners?
I think it's been one of the most surprising things that we've seen through this rebound in 2020 is the fact that we are at all-time highs. We're seeing a positive year-to-date return for the stock market, yet millions of people are still out of a job. And how does that make sense? Right? I think it doesn't in a lot of ways, and it's very, very surprising. And I think it creates a lot of uncertainty for folks, for investors, as well as for folks that are still out of work. When we think about the economy versus the stock market, when we think about these economic indicators, and that might be one to define later on, but they tend to be more backwards looking. How much unemployment do we have? That's usually from a previous time. It's measuring something that's already taken place. The stock market tends to be forward looking. And so investors are looking through to, you know, future earnings of companies. What will companies look like when once we are through the pandemic, through to the other side? And they're pricing some of that in. So I think that's one note. The second note that I would make, and I think Dr. Ibbotson made this very clear during your discussion with him as well, is the fact that we're seeing a stock market that's really being driven by a handful of large companies that are performing very well. And these are the companies that you would expect would perform well through this type of environment, where you're thinking kind of the tech companies that have been not only surviving through this crisis, but in some cases thriving. And that has really driven some of the market performance that we're seeing, where there's still a lot of companies that are continuing to struggle through this.
That's definitely an important point. Barb, what are your thoughts when we talk about the stock market versus the economy? I know you're a former portfolio manager.
Piggybacking on what Nicole said, just to give you a really clear picture of what's actually going on in the economy, the energy sector is down 46% year to date. The financial sector is down nearly 19% year to date. Utilities are down nearly 8%. So what you're seeing is an extremely bifurcated market. When we look at indexes, particularly market capitalization indexes, and a market capitalization index will lean towards bigger companies. They have a bigger piece of the index. And the market is driven 20% of the market returns, Dr. Ibbotson said, were driven by, I think, four or five stocks. And these biggest names, we call them FANG stocks, which is an acronym for Facebook, Amazon, Alphabet, Netflix, Google, are driving a large, large, large percentage of the returns today. Although in the long term, you will see a coming together of the direction of the growth of the economy with the stock market, they are not the same thing. And in the short term, you can see wildly divergent picture. Additionally, many, 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 many companies are not on the stock market. Go through your town and look at all these small businesses. They're not publicly traded stocks. So the stock market is only a reflection of a certain segment of the economy. So that's another reason why the economy is really struggling with high unemployment and so many business closures and is not fully realized within the publicly traded stocks.
That's a really important point, Barb, is that the stock market is not all companies in the U.S. It's really a small sliver of them, probably some of the largest companies in the U.S., but certainly businesses up and down your town are not included in the stock market, so it's not reflective of what's really going on in the economy. Megan, what are your thoughts in kind of looking at the economy versus stock market? Anything kind of come to mind when you're listening to the interview?
What we're seeing here, and this goes to this concept of a K-shaped recovery, is sort of two things at play. I think the first thing is that we have seen over the last 8 months significant policy response to trying to solve some of the issues that are going on today. And over the past couple of weeks, we've been watching Congress and the president go back and forth on another stimulus package. So there's public policy that's driving certain areas of the economy to do well, right? But then other areas are not to do well. I know Barbara brought up energy, but I think about things that are not just publicly traded, but things like restaurants and restaurant workers and how they're struggling and that there hasn't been any policy focused on them. I think the other thing that's at play here is much more of a historical thinking of it, which is you have new technologies replacing older technologies in the course of this recession. When you think about things like Zoom that have become incredibly popular. And so that typically happens when one age changes to another. And I think when we come out of this time period, we are going to be firmly in the technological age. But I want to also just sort of pivot really quickly, because I know we all know people who are investors or we work with clients, and I'm a big advocate of play accounts for clients. But one of the things that I have seen, and Nicole and Kirk, I'm sure you, I know Nicole's seen it because we work together, but Kirk, you've probably seen it with your clients, is I see a lot of people day trading and really focusing on those few stocks that Ibbotson talked about. And right now, everybody feels really clever and really good about what they're doing in the marketplace. But that type of behavior also concerns me going forward for investors who have focused money just on sort of four or five key stocks in the marketplace.
That's a really important point. I'm glad you brought it up, Megan. And actually, as I was looking at the chart for today, Barb, I think the energy sector is down about 50% as of now. So it's...
Anytime. And I was thinking, do I say as of what date? Because I was researching this, maybe a month ago. And so as quickly as you give some data, it's out of date.
What's less important is the numbers. What's more important is the trend and the fact that, you know, the energy sector is down, you know, the financial sector, the utility sector, they're all down. And yet you've got the technology sector, which is pretty much through the roof in comparison when you have an economy that's not doing very well. And you have an index that's not really indicative of a broad-based selection of stocks. Is more indicative of, as Roger said, 20% of the S&P is pretty much five stocks, which shouldn't really happen. Think about it logically, it doesn't make much sense. But it's happening. And, you know, there's a concept that we call reversion to the mean. And reversion to the mean is really kind of looking at when things get really out of kilter, let's say like in 1999, the market was going up, there was no stopping it until 2000, and then all of a sudden it reversed. You know, and you look at a lot of indicators that were really kind of out of kilter. And one of them is growth versus value, which we're going to talk about next, is, you know, when things go too far one way, they tend to correct and head back to the mean. Because otherwise, at a certain point, things stop making sense and people get wise to it. So getting back to your point about day trading, I think that's really important, is there are a lot of day traders that feel really smart right now. And companies that you're hearing about in the media, you know, you have these people day trading and quote unquote making lots of money. That's the same kind of attitude you hear when people come back from the casino. Oh yeah, I made lots of money at the casino today. You know, but they never tell you about the losses, or they never tell you about the other side of the coin, which inevitably will happen. So I think it's really important to keep in mind that this is a point in time. Right now, what you're looking at with the market is one point in time. And depending on what point in time you're looking at it, it could be positive, it could be negative. You know, there could be a strong trend in one direction, but things tend to change. And I think what people get wrapped up in is, you know, a recency bias, and they think that this trend will always continue and that, well, it's going up and it's going to keep going up. Well, it might, but you don't know. I think it's really important just to keep in mind that you may feel good now, but if you don't have really good risk management in place, then you potentially could lose all of that, all of the gains that you had made. So let's dip into the next topic, which is kind of value versus growth. This is something that a lot of people talk about, and it keeps coming up over and over and over again. Nicole, what are your thoughts on value versus growth from your perspective as a portfolio manager?
I mean, I think we've certainly seen dispersion between quote unquote value versus growth. And I always think about value stocks as buying a stock, that's buying a company that's on sale, right? That it's cheap compared to its intrinsic value. And then growth, we're basically buying future cash flows of the company, future profitability of the company that may or may not have happened yet, and are willing to potentially pay a premium for that. And what we've seen over the last decade or so is that these quote unquote growth companies have outperformed the value companies in a very, very major way. And I think to your point around reversion to the mean, you know, I think there is certainly a large group of folks out there that expect that this trend will reverse at some point. You will start to see these value stocks outperform. Now, when we think about that, what is the likelihood of that? When will that happen? How long will that take? You know, it's a good question, and it's one that's difficult to answer. What I will say is that I think that there are a lot of companies out there right now that are trading, quote unquote, cheaply because they're in these sectors that are still under a lot of pressure at this point. Once we see the economy break through the pandemic, once there is a widely distributed vaccine, we should start to see those companies pick up again. And we should start to see them, you know, gain traction. Now, does that mean that growth is going to underperform? Not necessarily. I think Megan had a very good point when she talked about that secular shift that we're seeing to new technologies. And I believe that will continue. I think where investors want to be very careful is making sure that they understand the stocks that they're buying and the future outlook of cash flows for those companies. So I think a lot of people are comparing what we're seeing today with the tech bubble in the early 2000s. And I think there's some big differences there. The biggest difference being that these companies are actually profitable. These companies are continuing to perform well. Now, will they continue to? I think Dr. Ibbotson made a very good point that we're going to see increased competition come in. You can't stay at the top forever. So we could see a shift. But I think the most important takeaway from my perspective is diversification, not choosing one or the other, but having different building blocks within the portfolio on both sides of companies that have these growth characteristics, companies that have value characteristics, so that you always have a piece of the portfolio that is working in some sense over time.
Yeah, I think the diversification is really important. One kind of follow-up question I want to ask you, Nicole, is because I think a lot of this comes down to valuations. And I talk with a lot of hedge fund managers that struggle with this. And, you know, they look at valuations and they just can't stomach paying for some of these absurd valuations. I mean, there's a very specific tech company in 99 is a big company. I won't mention the name for compliance reasons, but it's a big company and it has still not exceeded the valuation from 20 years ago because it was so expensive at that time that it just hasn't gotten back there. So it kind of makes me ask the question of like, you know, how do you look at valuations? Because that's really an important point. Even if you're a growth stock, if your valuations are sky high, there's no hope to ever exceed that. So how do you look at that?
I think that's a very important point, and certainly something that we are seeing today. And there's a number of companies out there right now. And again, I won't mention names, but there's a number of companies that have grown very, very quickly through this. And they have been short-term beneficiaries of the work from home, of you know what has happened to the economy through the pandemic. And we've seen these valuations skyrocket. I think as you know, as an investor, you need to be very careful about coming in at these levels, because to your point, they may not be able to sustain that valuation. And it's in some cases, you could argue that the valuations are factoring in unreasonable expectations going forward that aren't sustainable. So I think that's certainly something to be very, very careful about. I think from our perspective, when we think about growth companies, it has a little bit of a different lens. It's not growth or value in my mind. It's quality from my perspective. When we don't invest in individual companies, but when we're working with managers, understanding their investment process around how do you choose companies? And if you're going to pay a premium for them, how do you think about that? Do they have a sustainable competitive advantage in the marketplace? Are there strong management teams? Do they have strong outlook for profitability that's already been proven in their business model? Do they have recurring cash flow streams? These types of characteristics in a company when it is purchased at a reasonable price can be very, very interesting long term. But I would 100% agree. I think there are a number of companies right now where those valuations are so high that they just are not going to be sustainable in the long run.
Great. Well, appreciate that clarity. Barb, what are your thoughts on the growth versus value? I know you've done a lot of portfolio management in the past. So how do you look at that?
I like value because I like a bargain. I like to pay less than a company's intrinsic value. But to piggyback on something Nicole said, which is you need a diversified portfolio. The past 10 years, value companies, value mutual funds have performed poorly. The momentum growth approach to investing has prevailed. Does this mean that the same conditions will continue into the future? I don't know. I suspect no one knows unless they have that magical crystal ball. So the takeaway in my estimate is you want to be diversified enough so that you're not going to be a winner all the time, because that's pretty much impossible. But you will be able to profit when tides change from a growth focus to a value. Specifically, what this means, and I'm not talking to stock pickers here because that's a whole different conversation. But if you invest in mutual funds or in exchange traded funds, and I have a preference towards index funds in most cases because they're low fee and tend to match the market performance, which is usually tough to beat, I would say you might have a total Standard & Poor's or total stock market index fund in your portfolio, but then you might want to have a smaller proportion of your investments in a value fund, either just a total value fund, or you might consider investing in a equal weight Standard & Poor's index fund, 500 index fund, which would be something like the RSP, which is a fund that equally weights every single company in the portfolio. Unlike the Standard & Poor's 500 index funds, the larger companies get a bigger weight and are thus a greater part of the returns. The RSP, the smaller, the undervalued companies, have the same weight as the bigger, more popular stocks. Now, recently, RSP has not performed like a Standard & Poor's fund, but over the long term, that gives you a little bit of a hedge so that when value does start outperforming, you may be able to profit from that trend as well.
And I'd encourage the listeners to compare the performance of the S&P to the RSP as just a, you know, comparison from an equal weight to an unequal weight, and just kind of notice the difference. A lot of people get stuck in comparing things that are not really a good comparison. They might have like 50% bonds and they're trying to keep up with the S&P 500 index or whatever it might be. There's not usually like an equal comparison. But if you're looking at those two, you can kind of see like how is the market doing in comparison to some of the largest companies, which are overweighting the performance of the index.
Kirk, I just want to throw in a disclosure in that I own RSP. I also own SPY, which is a market capitalization S&P 500 fund. So I need to put that out there.
There's many ways to invest in it. So I think it's an index, that's one way. But I think what's really important is just kind of understanding the differences in that sometimes it's more obvious than others. Megan, when you kind of look at growth versus value, I mean, you've been doing this for a while. So what are your opinions on growth versus value when you look at investing for clients?
I'll probably echo Barb and Nicole's point of view, you know, which is I like a deal, but I can't outthink the market. I just know that's not possible. So I think in portfolio construction, it is good to have a balance of both. Now, one of the things that I really want to make sure we talk about is I was really fascinated in the interview with Ibbotson's take on bonds. And I know when Barb and Nicole and Kirk, we talked before the show, we all sort of had a point of view on it. And I don't know if you mind, Kirk, if we shift over to that part of this.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I was surprised just because for me in portfolio construction, bonds are the ballast of the portfolio. They smooth the ride. And I got the impression he wasn't a fan of them going forward. And I'm curious what Nicole and Barb and Kirk, you think on that.
It was definitely surprising to me as well. You know, I think we're clearly in a very, very low interest rate environment. And we're also seeing bonds being priced at very close to fair value, if not above it. And so I think the point that Dr. Ibbinson was making is the fact that you don't really have room for capital appreciation within bonds. But going back to, you know, what Megan mentioned around portfolio construction, you know, that's not really the role of bonds from my perspective. It's really to act as that anchor within the portfolio. As Megan said, it's really there to smooth the ride. And at the end of the day, it also allows you to be proactive. And so having that portfolio of fixed income allows us to use that as a source of capital to buy stocks when the market is down. So that's a very important role that it plays as well from a portfolio management perspective. I think the most important takeaway is that if you're not investing in bonds, where are you going to invest that allocation or that bucket of capital? Low interest rates have pushed people either down in credit quality, meaning that investing in the bonds of companies that are more risky and potentially might not pay you back that loan that you're making to them. And so that can be very risky in terms of where you're putting that allocation. On the other side, I think that's also pushing folks into more equities. And then all of a sudden, the risk profile of the portfolio is pretty off kilter and is taking on more volatility and more risk than maybe was intended when it was first set up.
We've definitely seen a lot of new clients who come over this year, and wherever they were before, they were like 80, 90% in equities, and these people are like a few years from retirement. I mean, historically, you can look at that and shake your head and just say, this is completely irresponsible. But on the other hand, I also recognize that probably the advisors are thinking, well, we're underperforming the index and, you know, we need to put more in equities because you're not earning anything in bonds, which is fine if you're trying to compete with the index. But if you're getting ready to retire and the market goes down 50%, there's not a lot of time to recover from that. I mean, it's highly dangerous. And I don't think a lot of them really understand that, you know, the risk involved at that stage in life. You know, I mean, obviously you don't know what the future holds, but you know that if, you know, March happened again and it was more severe and it doesn't come back, that's really the fear. It's not that we have another March because that came back. It's the fear that we have another March and it doesn't come back and it just stagnates. We become Japan. That's my fear in the markets, is that that happens. I mean, it came back rather quickly, which certainly shocked me. But I think that you really, it's what it comes down to is just kind of how do you manage the risk. Megan, what are your thoughts on bonds?
We don't have clients look at them as a place for appreciation. It really is the safe sleep at night part of the portfolio. I think what I challenge investors, and we run into this all the time, is, you know, the bonds are not where you should be seeking equity type returns. And that really you should be focusing on high credit quality. So what I have been concerned about over the past couple of years is when I've had people, they've moved the portfolio to us or they ask us to give an opinion on their current portfolio, I'm always amazed how many I see them stretching for yield and taking on credit risk. And to me, that's what's concerning. It's all about building something that is an all-weather, conservative, stable allocation to help smooth the ride. There's nothing sexy about bonds, but I'm okay with that.
That's great. And Barb, what about you? What are your thoughts on bonds right now?
Well, I think one of the things that he did not touch on, Dr. Ibbinson, is the fact that, yes, in the past, bonds have delivered over the past maybe close to 100 years, an average, and this is an average basket of corporate bonds, an average return of 5%. Going forward, with interest rates barely hitting 1 or 2%, and typical bonds, good quality bonds, really down to 1 or 2%, you're not going to have an average of 5% returns on bonds at this time. So that is a reality. So what you have to think about is, okay, interest rates will go up in the future. That's likely. I don't think they're going to go up to the level that they were in the past, which gave us the higher bond yields. So we have to understand that bond yields may be low for a while, but that doesn't mean you want to avoid them completely. Because as we all know, the stock market is super volatile. And during 2000, 2001, 2002, the S&P 500 lost each year 9%, 11.85%, and 21.97% in 2002. So if you were in 100% stocks, you would have lost a lot of your assets. If you had some bonds to offset that, maybe you wouldn't have gotten a ton of growth. Let's just say you only got 1% in your bond portfolio. It sure would have smoothed out those losses a lot. So you need some sort, unless you don't care, you know, and unless you're fine with losing, you know, 30, 40, 50% of your portfolio in 1 year, which can happen with the knowledge that over the long term, the stock market typically goes up. But if you're like most people, that would hurt a lot. And so accept the fact bond yields are low, lower than they have been in the past, and they're likely to stay lower. And as interest rates rise, the value of your existing bonds that you own or your bond portfolio, well, it's going to temper down the value of those existing bonds. So you need to understand the relationship between interest rates and bonds. When interest rates go up, bond values go down. But you also have to realize that there aren't a lot of other alternatives, and accept the fact that returns have been incredibly high over the past 20, 30, 40 years, if you look at it on an average basis. And it's unlikely they're going to continue at that level going forward.
That's an important insight there, too, in thinking about whether the future is going to reflect the past. And I know every piece of marketing material ever created for the financial industry is, you know, past performance is not an indication of future results. However, everyone looks at past performance as an indication of future results, regardless of what that says.
What else do we have? And that's the real problem, because nobody has a crystal ball.
To that point, that's a great question, is what else do we have? What happens when you kind of tend to look at the past is there's kind of like a sense of intellectual laziness, I guess I would call it. And it's not meant to be insulting about anybody, but it's the whole industry does this in that we assume, I'll give you an example. So I work with a nonprofit with their investment committee. And everyone on the committee is really bright. Like they're all from notable firms that you've probably all heard. And you know, the conversation is around bonds. And it's like, yeah, we know that we're probably going to get 0% interest rates. And just for reference, I looked at some CDs this morning for someone, and the most we could go out for 2 years was 10 basis points. So you might as well keep it in cash. But the conversation was around, you know, what do we do? And everyone acknowledged the fact that, well, yes, we recognize we're not going to get much on bonds, but we feel we have to. There's a sense of liability. There's, you know, there's kind of this decade-long assumption that bonds are safe, that you have to have a certain amount in bonds, and that is the solution. And I know there are plenty of people looking for better solutions, and I'm not ignoring that. But I think there's a real concern that people are just taking the assumption that bonds are safe, and they're saying, well, we've always done it this way. I'm not going to try to do anything different. So I'm just going to go along with the herd. At some point, bonds lose money. And a lot of the models that people have created around bonds just don't work. They're assuming that bonds are going to make money over time because bonds for the last, 40 years have gone up in price. At some point, that'll reverse. So then what happens? In my opinion, it's people need to be intellectually more agile in their thinking, and that they should be trying to think outside the box with other ways to handle this, because bonds are not going to be a great asset forever. There will be trends where they're in bull markets and bear markets. And we've been fortunate for the last 40 years that bonds have been in a bull market, which means that most people have not seen a bond bear market. And I think that's one of the fears, is that if we haven't seen it, you haven't experienced it, then how is that going to impact a lot of the models and the portfolios that people have? You know, it's kind of like the same philosophy of real estate always goes up that got us into the real estate bubble. People just assume real estate always went up. And so they modeled for that and the models blew up. So what happens with bonds when interest rates go up? With portfolios, all of a sudden, a lot of things that people are doing stop working at best. And at worst, there's systemic problems. That's how I look at bonds. I mean, at this point, there's, as Nicole stated, there's certainly credit quality that's important. And when you have high yield bonds that are yielding historically low rates that I guess I would argue are under the default rate, that's a risk. And at what point do you just say, it's better to have it in cash or T-bills because you're not getting paid for the risk that you're taking? That's kind of how I look at it. It's not an answer. It's just more of just pointing out the fact that there are some serious, significant issues that need to be discussed. And I would rather be in cash or T-bills than being in bonds right now, because bonds really are not giving you that portfolio, the muting of the portfolio, the smoothing out of the portfolio that it used to give you. Is if the market crashes here and bonds are at zero, where are they going to go? Negative 3%? I mean, it's possible, I guess, but it's the point of once you're close to the zero boundary, you know, where do you go? You're kind of limited on the smoothing of the portfolio that's going to take place. That's where I go with it. I don't know if you had any kind of final thoughts, Megan.
This was a pretty extensive conversation today on a lot of what he said. So what I liked about his interview is that it got us talking about things that are really being talked about in client meetings, particularly in the high net worth space, but I don't know if the regular investor gets to discuss these things. So thanks for having me on, Kirk. And you can find me on Twitter at Wealth Intersect.
Thanks for coming on, Megan. Barb, final thoughts from you?
Yeah, Kirk, to echo what you said, don't be afraid of cash. Cash is not horrible. And when the markets decline, your cash value will stay the same. That's my final thought. My name is Barbara Friedberg, and you can find me at Robo Advisor Pros or Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance. Thanks for having me on, Kirk, and I'll look forward to talking to you again next time.
Thanks for coming on, Barb, and we will certainly put a link to your article in the show notes as well. Nicole, final thoughts from you?
Making sure that you stay diversified and that you are spreading that risk across the portfolio. Thank you so much for having me on, and it was a great show.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Nicole. I'm glad we were able to borrow your expertise for the day. So that's it for the show this week. Thank you again for joining us on Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to all the resources, show notes, and the archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get better access to some of the top guests that you're going to want to hear. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.